IB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. According to a climate scorecard published in August, over the last 5 years, the top 100 ranked law firms in the United States facilitated $1.36 trillion of fossil fuel transactions, represented fossil fuel clients in 358 legal cases, and received $35 million in compensation for their work to assist fossil fuel industry lobbying. We now present you an article written by Isabella Kaminsky. The piece is titled U.S. Fossil Fuel Companies Paying Top Law Firms Millions to Dodge Responsibility. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. The world's biggest corporate law firms have been making millions of dollars representing fossil fuel companies, but as the climate crisis intensifies, this work is coming under increasing scrutiny. According to a climate scorecard published in August, over the last 5 years, the top 100 ranked law firms in the United States facilitated $1.36 trillion of fossil fuel transactions, represented fossil fuel clients in 358 legal cases, and received $35 million in compensation for their work to assist fossil fuel industry lobbying. Tim Herschel Burns, a third-year student at Yale Law School and co-founder of Law Students for Climate Accountability, which developed the scorecard, said, "The scale of the law firm's work for the fossil fuel industry is huge." He added, "As we started digging, we realized how holistic this is. Everything fossil fuel companies want to do, they need lawyers to accomplish." Fossil fuel companies rely heavily on armies of lawyers to advise on projects, lobby, negotiate contracts, secure permits, and navigate an increasing number of climate lawsuits. Law firms' fossil fuel industry work has increased compared with the previous year's scorecard, even as climate warnings become more dire and the International Energy Agency, the IEA, has warned new fossil fuel development is incompatible with the target of net zero emissions by 2050. The climate scorecard awarded firms grades based on their involvement in lawsuits exacerbating climate change, their support for fossil fuel transactions, and fees received for lobbying on behalf of the fossil fuel industry. Paul Weiss, a top 10 U.S. firm according to VaultLaw's rankings, was one of the 37 to receive the lowest F grade. According to the scorecard, the firm, which has its own sustainability practice, has acted for fossil fuel companies in 30 cases over the last 5 years. Among the most high profile was the firm's work representing ExxonMobil in a landmark trial where the company was accused of having misled investors about the risks of climate change to its business. The court ruled in favor of ExxonMobil in 2019. Paul Weiss did not respond to a request for comment. Only 12 law firms were rated A or B in the scorecard, which meant they did not conduct work for fossil fuel clients. According to the scorecard report, 3 firms, Cooley, Wilson Sonsini Goodrich and Rosati, and Shorter Roth and Zabel, have actively addressed the climate crisis through renewable energy transactions, lobbying, or pro-climate litigation. Tim Herschel Burns said, "We definitely agree that the law can be this force for good. But one thing that we found really striking is that overwhelmingly the top law firms are representing the wrong side of it." Alyssa Joel, legal director for the Center for Climate Integrity, said, "There is a tangible human cost." Alyssa Joel added, "Elite law firms are representing the oil and gas companies and providing them with a deep bench of high-priced lawyers." She said, "For the communities across the country that are seeking justice, the end result is that their cases have been delayed and bogged down by procedural hurdles put forward by some of the biggest law firms in the country." Law Students for Climate Accountability is calling on law firms to pledge to stop taking on new fossil fuel industry work, phase out their current work by 2025, and ramp up their work for the renewable energy industry and in support of litigation to tackle the climate crisis. It's a potentially controversial stance given the principle that everyone should have access to legal representation. But Tim Herschel Burns said, "This principle is often used in really sloppy ways which end up justifying law firms being able to represent whoever pays the most." Some firms have acknowledged the choice. Speaking at a conference last year about the link between law and climate change, the global senior partner at Clifford Chance Jeroen Urnhand said, "Firms can choose what we support and what we don't support. We do not have to be neutral professional service providers." Law firms are starting to ramp up their own climate action, even as they continue their fossil fuel work. A number of firms that scored F grades on the climate scorecard, including Shearman and Sterling and Hogan Lovells, have signed up to the Net Zero Lawyers Alliance, which launched in July. Members pledge to achieve net zero emissions by 2050 and to work with clients to embed climate goals and to help drive systematic change. Neither firm responded to the Guardian's request for comment. Another alliance member, DLA Piper, has set its own science-based target to halve all emissions by 2030, including indirect emissions from the firm's supply chain. The firm was recently appointed official legal service provider for the forthcoming COP26 climate talks in Glasgow, but it scored only a D on the climate scorecard and has represented clients including Shell, ExxonMobil, and BP. The firm declined to comment. Tom Wetzer, a law professor and director of the Oxford Sustainable Law Programme, one of the organisations supporting the alliance, said, "The firms may be serious about taking steps in the right direction, but they do not necessarily have the best practices as yet." Tom Wetzer added, we need to move the whole sector, and for many firms involved, this is the start of a long journey. Some law firms that ranked low on their climate scorecard were keen to promote their green energy work. Allen and Overy, which according to the scorecard worked on fossil fuel transactions worth $125 billion over the last 5 years, claimed in a statement that it does more renewable work than any other law firm in the world by most key measures. Clifford Chance, which the scorecard calculated worked on fossil fuel transactions worth $123 billion, said it is perennially at or near the top for advising on renewable financing. But neither firm, both of which scored an F, responded to questions about how they reconcile their work with their representation of fossil fuel firms. Tom Wetzer said lawyers have a responsibility to reflect on their own role and to ask whether their clients' values align with their own. He added, firms that engage constructively with a net zero transition will be rewarded. Clients will value their judgment and expertise. Top talent will be more easily attracted and retained, and these firms will strengthen their social license to operate. Sam Sankar of the non-profit environmental law organization Earth Justice, which makes the climate scorecard a powerful tool, said law firms' best resource is their employees, adding, in the future, nobody is going to think twice about making career decisions with an eye to whether it aligns with their climate ethics. Sam Sankar said, there is now a conversation about legal ethics and climate, which is well overdue, adding, the fossil fuel industry is paying law firms tons of money in an effort to dodge responsibility and block regulatory reforms that could help avert this crisis.
Africa Today.
The people of Morocco have been holding protests to condemn, in their strongest possible terms, their country's recent move to sign a military cooperation agreement with the Israeli regime. Now, this pact comes after a normalization deal between the two sides that continue to be condemned. Moroccans have held massive rallies to reject their government's move.
Today we are here as much as with all Moroccans, human rights organizations, political unions that support the Palestinian people, that denounce the war crimes of the Zionist occupation against the Palestinian people. We are also against the normalization of relations of the Moroccan state with Zionism.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on increasing demonstrations by the people of Morocco who oppose their government's move to normalize ties with the Israeli regime. Moroccans consider such a move as betrayal to the Palestinian cause. In the second part of our program, we shall discuss plans to develop a battery minerals industry in the Democratic Republic of Congo. If this plan materializes, it is expected to open a new era that will transform the country's economy. Stay tuned as our experts give us incisive analysis on these two issues.
Moroccans reject normalization with Israel. Anger and resentment is increasing in Morocco against the country's move to normalize ties with the brutal Israeli regime, which continues to commit atrocities against Palestinians while occupying the territories. Recently, demonstrators took to the streets in several cities across Morocco to protest Rabat's normalization of ties with the Israeli regime and the recent military agreements signed between the two sides.
The demonstrators chanted anti-Israeli regime slogans calling for an end to normalization of relations between Rabat and Tel Aviv and expressing their full and unflinching support for the liberation of Palestine. Now, for an insight on Moroccans' rejection of normalization of ties with the Israeli regime, my colleague contacted Sami Hamdi, editor-in-chief of the International Interest. Now, we first asked Mr. Hamdi if the rulers of Morocco are listening to the people who are visibly angry at the kingdom's move to normalize ties with the Israeli regime.
The Moroccan government did not normalize ties with Israel in a vacuum, but rather suggested that its normalization of ties with Israel was in exchange for the U.S. recognizing Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara, in that the Moroccan government sought to add some sort of nuance to the debate, in that the normalization of ties was not necessarily done out of any regard for Israel, but rather as part of this wider strategy of asserting Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara. And this is what perhaps divided Moroccan public opinion and prevented the Moroccans from adopting a unified stance in terms of being against normalization of ties.
Now, as Mr. Hamdi mentioned there, Morocco's decision to normalize ties with the Israeli regime came after former U.S. President Donald Trump recognized the North African country's sovereignty over Western Sahara, which has been at the center of a decades-old territorial dispute between Morocco and the Polisario Front. Now, Mouloud Said, a representative of the Polisario Front in Washington, says the recognition will not change the facts about Western Sahara.
But this decision is not going to change the facts that the Sahrawi Republic is a full member of the African Union, that Morocco occupies part of this territory, and it's not going to change the nature of the conflict. This decision, it was done without advancing any legal argument, because they will not find it anywhere. And Western Sahara is not just a piece of real estate that President Trump can give. It's a territory that belongs to its people, and a full-fledged member of a continental organization.
Morocco annexed the vast Western Sahara region, a former Spanish colony, in the 1970s, and has since been in conflict with the Polisario Front, a movement that seeks to establish an independent state in the territory and end Morocco's presence there. The people of Morocco insist that the issue of Western Sahara should not be linked to support for Palestinian liberation, and they have therefore rejected normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Despite attempts by the regime in Morocco to ban the protests, people turned out in masses to support Palestine and reject normalization with the Israeli regime. Why is the Kingdom of Morocco going against popular demands and insisting on normalization of ties with the Israeli regime?
I think that this is rather another series in the latest chapter, or another chapter in this series of relations between Morocco and Israel, and that Morocco, which has become increasingly frustrated over the issue of the Western Sahara, as it sees a lack of progress towards recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara, Morocco believes that given now there's this wave of normalization with Israel on the basis that Israel will provide guarantees of access to the White House or favorable influence in the White House, Morocco believes that if the UAE is benefiting from that, if Qatar has benefited from that in the past, if Mohammed bin Salman has been benefiting from that, then Morocco also can benefit from that.
In November, Israeli regime's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, and Moroccan Defense Minister Abdellatif Loldigi signed a military and espionage cooperation agreement in Rabat. Now, this agreement attracted widespread condemnation inside Morocco.
We came to protest against the visit of the war criminal, the Zionist minister, to Morocco. We don't accept this. And we consider it a mistake and a betrayal. He is a war criminal who should be prosecuted, and his place is not in our country.
Now, what are the implications of the military pact between the Israeli regime and Morocco, especially for neighboring Algeria and the entire Maghreb region?
I think when it comes to the implications for Algeria or for the neighboring countries, I think the implications are quite grave, and that's why Algiers has been particularly upset over normalization of ties with Morocco, and why after the Israeli foreign minister Yair Lapid criticized Algeria from Rabat, from Morocco, Algeria decided to suspend diplomatic ties with Morocco and then close its airspace to Moroccan planes, because the reality is that there are a number of issues in the region in which the Americans are heavily involved in that matter to Algeria, whether that's with regards to Mali, whether that's with regards to the civil war in Libya. And the belief is that with Morocco's ties with Israel, Israel will levy those ties or use its influence in the White House against Algeria's interest in the region, as it seeks to appease Morocco in order to encourage Morocco to really expand on these ties, to really expand the normalization and not reverse course. In other words, even if normalization was built on originally on an exchange of interest, Israel is very keen to ensure that these relations improve into something different, and therefore it may well be that Israel will seek to deliver on that by bringing the U.S. influence to bear on Algeria in Morocco's favor.
The normalization deal between Morocco and Israel in December triggered fresh tensions between Rabat and Algiers. The president of Algeria denounced the normalization deals and categorically stated that his country will continue supporting Palestine.
Now, we finally asked Mr. Sami Hamdi his opinion on the claim by Moroccan authorities that normalization of ties with the Israeli regime aims to serve the kingdom's interests while claiming that they still support the Palestinian people.
It's clear in the region, with regards to the regimes at least, that Palestine is no longer a priority. We saw Gulf media in Saudi Arabia and in the UAE almost repeating Israeli narratives on the Palestinian issue, criticizing Hamas and criticizing Palestinian factions for the military escalation that took place during the Gaza war. In other words, Palestine is no longer this unifying issue with regards to the regime. So for Morocco, Morocco argues that, you know, it cannot be more royal than royalty. In other words, that they will not take the lead on the Palestinian issue. The way the tides in the region are shifting, their priority is the Western Sahara. Normalization of ties with Israel helps to bring about U.S. recognition of Moroccan sovereignty of the Western Sahara. That's what matters, not the Palestinian issue. And I think that's the reality of what is unfolding.
Well, there you have it. The Kingdom of Morocco has betrayed Palestinians in favor of ties with the brutal Israeli regime occupying Palestinian territories. But the people of Morocco have clearly chosen to side with the oppressed Palestinians. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall talk about how the Democratic Republic of Congo plans to develop a regional industry of electric battery minerals. Stay with us. The Democratic Republic of Congo Africa Business Forum 2021 was held last November. Now, the theme of the forum was economic integration of the Congolese in the value chain of the electric battery industry through innovative financial solutions.
During the event in the Congolese capital, Kinshasa, a series of firm commitments were signed for the development of a battery mineral industry in the Democratic Republic of Congo. To put words into action, stakeholders agreed to create a battery council in the DRC in order to set up a special financial vehicle to facilitate private investments and the participation of the population.
The United Nations Economic Commission for Africa was one of the stakeholders at the forum. Now, the Commission's Executive Secretary speaks here on the Kinshasa Forum.
As the world becomes increasingly conscious of the need to pursue net zero carbon emissions against the specter of global climate disaster, a movement for green productivity and consumption is gaining traction. That's why a global battery electric vehicle industry is growing at a fast pace and is projected to be worth $8.8 trillion by 2025. Africa is in a good position to profit from this global movement towards decarbonization, as it is home to key battery minerals such as cobalt, copper, lithium, and manganese. The DRC is a case in point. It currently supplies 70% of the world's cobalt use in electric vehicle manufacture, but captures no more than 3% of the battery electric vehicle mining value chain. But how much transformation will happen to DRC and other African countries currently engaged in producing and selling raw materials will only depend on how fast they move up.
Well, now for more on the economic integration of the DRC in the value chain of the electric battery industry, we contacted Africa Kiiza, a development anthropologist and a trade policy analyst at Southern and Eastern Africa Trade. Information and Negotiations Institute, Uganda. Now, we first asked Mr. Kiza if he finally sees light at the end of the tunnel in terms of the DRC adding value to its minerals and thus realizing the dream of its heroic independence hero, Patrice Lumumba.
Since independence of Africa, industrialization through mineral beneficiation has been high on the continent's agenda and on African countries' national development agendas. However, this has over time been hampered and constrained by the continuous primary commodity dependence, where Africa has been locked into supply of raw materials to its former colonial masters. But the current move by, for example, DRC to add value on its minerals reflects the new agenda of Africa be able to, and the new resolve by Africa be able to become self-sustaining through mineral beneficiation, through adding value on its products. So yes, it is a good move and it reflects the new independent Africa.
In a speech at the Economic Forum, DRC President Felix Tshisekedi said that with its cobalt and other battery minerals, the country must play a frontline role in greening the world's economy. He also invited other African countries to participate in the electric battery industry projects.
I would like to invite my African counterparts to seize the opportunity to build the battery industry together. The market for electric vehicles is projected to represent $8 trillion by 2025 and $46 trillion by 2050.
The president of the DRC also expressed a strong political commitment to the project by stating the machine is now launched, is necessary to start right after this forum. What else is needed to make this project a success apart from the political will by the government?
The question of finance, of course, apart from political will, is very critical. Quite often we have seen Africa's agenda, government agenda, Africa's industrial initiatives being financed by other powers like the EU, like the US, Canada. And to me, I think this already robs Africa of policy space, of sovereignty, but also on determining the pace of implementation of such agendas. And that's why you find that, for example, technical advisors, experts, engineers, and all that often come from the development partners. And so it is important that apart from political will, resources and financing capacities are generated within Africa, within the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Now, according to experts, the Democratic Republic of Congo can leverage its abundant cobalt resources and hydroelectric power to become a low-cost and low-emissions producer of electric batteries. A participant of the DRC Africa Business Forum 2021 elaborates here.
The United States, you take Poland, and you take China, as well as the DRC. If you wanted to build a precursor plant today, you are looking at a scenario where the DRC will be the cheapest place to build it. It would only cost $39 million to build a 10,000 metric tons capacity plant. If you are going to build this in the United States, you're looking at $120 million.
Now, if the DRC electric battery industry is a success, then clearly this initiative will rewrite the narrative of Africa and its economic effects will spread throughout the continent. Now, are we seeing a new Africa emerging? This is a question we pose to Mr. Kiza.
To avoid being pessimistic, indeed, if I can show a bit of optimism, if the electric battery project is a success, it will be one of the examples to show that yes, can be done. But again, to me, the question is, what kind of success we envisage project to be? Is it the success that is engineered, that is shared by Africans, by the citizens of the DRC? Because if it is the success that is that is being championed by China, by EU, by North America, by Canada, then this is not the kind of success one. But yes, the narrative of Africa rising, Africa reimagining for the better, has been high on the agenda, and indeed it has gained currency.
At the meeting, Bosch, a German multinational, made a commitment to work with African actors engaged in the development of this electric battery industry in the DRC. There is deep concern that the people of Congo might not get the benefits they deserve from this project. Mr. Kiese says there are no conclusive safeguards in place to ensure that the Congolese own the upcoming electric battery industry project.
The question of really ownership of such projects by Africans, I always grow cold feet when I see a foreign international claiming to support Africa in implementing its own development initiatives. And to me, I think development financing should be from within. For Africa, for this project to be able to materialize, there should be as less contact, as less financing, as less support by the third parties as possible.
The president of Zambia also attended the Kinshasa forum and said he is offended by the fact that 8 of the 15 mineral producing countries in the world are African, while the value added is in industrialized countries.
I think those countries that are producing the electric cars,
les véhicules électriques,
must see the opportunity we the Africans see. And obviously, it is easy to find common ground. And common ground is there. Working together,
travail ensemble,
technology, as I said, finance,
the finance,
resource holders, ourselves, we would achieve this balance for mutual benefit.
We asked Mr. Kiese if the industrialized countries, especially in the West, will agree to easily lose their monopoly in the electric battery industry. Now, there is also concern that they might put impediments to the DRC's project.
We can take an example of, for example, oil, and how there have been coups, there have been assassinations, there have been toppling of governments, facilitated and financed by the United States, by the way. Is on the record. Confessions and economic hitman, then Perkins talks about this, especially because when such countries start to control their oil and natural resources, the USA does not allow that. So I don't see this project taking shape because there are many vested interests by the third parties, by the already industrialized countries. Because you can look at an example. The EU has what they call a raw material initiative, which looks at increasing access to raw materials. Now, I don't see a situation where the EU, for example, where Belgium, where the UK, where Germany will allow for their countries, for their industries to be starved of raw materials and allow the ERC electric battery project to thrive.
The United States recently dispatched special forces to the Democratic Republic of Congo, and this has raised doubts if the DRC can independently add value to its minerals without interference from the United States and others. Now, Mr. Kiese believes that the U.S. plays a destabilizing role wherever it goes, and so the DRC is no exception.
The United States has often been known to play a destabilizing role and function in mineral-rich countries, be it Sierra Leone, be it Liberia, be it DRC, be it any other country, be it Angola. The United States has often been a bad actor to ensure that there are prolonged insurgencies, there are prolonged wars. I don't see the entry and the involvement of the United States in the Congo as a big as something that we should celebrate as Africans, as the Democratic Republic of Congo, because again, it is most important that there is as little interference as possible from the third parties when it comes to implementation of this project. Self-determination is something that the Democratic Republic of the Congo requires now in order to be able to implement this project.
Well, there you have it. The Democratic Republic of Congo will only succeed in adding value to its minerals if the country is truly independent and devoid of foreign interference. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you. Goodbye for now, and God bless you.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Besides defending geographical borders, martyrs defend religious, spiritual, and cultural borders.
This is part of the speech delivered on November 21st, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials in charge of conducting the Martyrs of Ilam commemoration ceremony.
On February 12, 1987, two young teams from Ilam played in a soccer match in commemoration of the seventh victory of the revolution. The people had gathered there as well as spectators, but an Iraqi plane struck them from up close. It is necessary for these events to be made known to people on a global level. They should be repeatedly mentioned here and there, because this is the message of the innocence of our athletic martyrs, whose only crime was that they had organized a soccer match for the Islamic Republic. With the support of which power did the malicious Saddam commit that appalling, brazen crime? Who was behind him? The same people who used to support the bloodthirsty wolf on that day are claiming to be advocates of human rights today. They describe themselves as the guardians of human rights throughout the world. There is so much brazenness and shamelessness in the actions of these powers. Who should reveal their true colors? Who should reveal these truths? Our artists and our writers have a heavy load on their shoulders. They have a heavy duty. These things should be presented to the world using art as the medium. They should make films about these events. In the case of the massacre at the soccer match, they should write stories, make films, and compose memoirs. These actions should be taken.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One of the unique characteristics of the province of Ilam is that there are families with 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 10 martyrs. As pointed out by the gentleman, there is one family with 10 martyrs, another with 9, another with 8, and some with 5 or 6 martyrs. This is only easy in words, but it is truly difficult to even think about it. Ilam is like this. There are such families in Ilam. It was mentioned that some members of these families are present in this commemoration ceremony. I hope that God will bestow His mercy and grace on all of you. Another characteristic of Ilam was the wholehearted presence of people from all social backgrounds, from scholars to the common people. For instance, the late Sheikh Abdul Rahman Haydari, may God's mercy be upon him, was with me on the Maymak Hills. He was with me at the top of that summit. He was with me everywhere I went.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Cinema Verite is the only festival in Iran that honors documentary filmmakers. The week-long cinematic event closed with an award ceremony in Tehran and prized the top documentaries of the year by filmmakers from Iran and the world. There's no limit for the themes of the entries. They can cover the sufferings of war-ravaged nations or deal with the socioeconomic impacts of the coronavirus. Among the films that received an award this year was Alireza Memariani's Broken Bones. The feature documentary narrates a bone setter's concern about wildlife in Iran's southern Hormuz Island and his continuous effort to raise awareness of the critically endangered local deer, that are falling victim to human intervention in their habitat. It's the 15th edition of Cinema Verite. Last year, it was held online due to the coronavirus pandemic. And this year, the films were screened both online and in theaters. 551 films were submitted to the Cinema Verite Secretariat, out of which 179 works were selected and put to contest. Foreign laureates were not present in the festival due to the pandemic, and their awards were handed to representatives from their country's embassies.
Documentaries must glue the audience to their seats with true yet touching stories instead of fiction, and with genuine scenes instead of visual effects. So docs that nabbed the Cinema Verite Award are definitely worth the top of the list of our must-watch films. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says they have carried out another retaliatory attack against several targets in Saudi Arabia. He said the Yemen military struck aircraft hangars at the King Khalid Air Base in Asir region and other sensitive targets in Jizan with five ballistic missiles.
This operation is part of the campaign to put pressure on the Saudi enemy because it only understands the language of force, and the silence of the international community encourages the Saudi regime to shed Yemeni's blood. We are carrying out military operations to make the Saudi regime understand that it must stop its airstrikes that are killing civilians all over the country. And we will continue to target Saudi facilities until the war stops.
Sariya said the attack came in response to the escalation of airstrikes by Saudi Arabia against Yemeni civilians. He vowed larger attacks unless Riyadh stops its ongoing war and siege.
These attacks come in the context of responding to the crimes of the Saudi enemy and the Saudi escalation in targeting civilians with air raids, whether in Sana'a or in other provinces. The Yemeni retaliatory attacks have penetrated the Saudi airspace and paralyzed the Saudi military. It is our right to respond to Saudi Arabia until the war and siege stop.
Recently, Saudi Arabia has been intensifying its airstrikes across Yemen and killing more civilians, including children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to launch further operations deep inside the kingdom.
Yemenis believe that the army has the right to hit back at those killing Yemeni women and the children and violating the sovereignty of their country. They say Riyadh should come to realize that the more attacks it conducts against Yemeni civilians, the more painful retaliatory strikes will be carried out against Saudi facilities. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
French President Emmanuel Macron didn't give a press conference until more than 2 years into his presidency, but he gave a two-hour televised interview shortly after the publication of the first poll, which shows him losing in the second round of the April election. The primary of the mainstream conservative party recently selected Valérie Pécresse, a former budget minister under Nicolas Sarkozy, and a new poll has her beating Macron 52-48 in the final round.
The traditional conservatives are bouncing high in the polls, thanks to the buzz from being newly united around a single person. They've lost a lot of votes in 2017 due to their candidates' perceived corruption. But with a restructured party and message, the rumors of their total demise may have been premature.
In 2017, the conservative candidate, François Fillon, was disgraced by a tremendous scandal over fake jobs, and yet he still almost made the second round. Many say the poll is a reminder of the historic strength of the mainstream conservative party, and also of Emmanuel Macron's almost permanently low approval ratings.
The one thing this poll makes clear is that Pécresse will at least be among the top three candidates of the first round. For her to advance, she really needs the support of Marine Le Pen to crumble, and also to attract many of Macron's dissatisfied voters, but it's too early to say if that will happen.
Pécresse hasn't come out of nowhere, but few expected that she would be in this position. She is often considered the conservative most similar to Macron, so a Pécresse-Macron final round won't offer many arguments in terms of policy. In the interview, Macron rejected his nickname, President of the Rich, but also promised that his re-election will bring right-wing changes to pensions that could cost him with older voters. He repeatedly admitted that he has made mistakes in his comportment, but not in his policies, and claimed that the corona pandemic made him more sensitive to the needs of the average person. Many said the interview appeared like a campaign speech, but Macron has still not yet declared if he is running for re-election. Armin Mazahari, Paris.
Turkey's central bank voted to lower the interest rate of the country once again from 15% to 14%. This has directly affected the lira, which reached a record low of 15.5 right after the announcement. The Turkish lira has lost 50% of its value against the US dollar since the beginning of this year. In a trial to drag the attention of the public from the drop in lira value, Turkish president finally announced the raise in minimum wage after long negotiations between the government and opposition. Tayyip Erdogan said the increase would be 50%, making the minimum wage 4,253 Turkish lira.
The increase in minimum wage is 50%, the highest raise in the last 50 years. I believe that with this increase, we have shown our determination not to crush our employees in the face of price hikes.
Analysts refer to the public anti-government protests, saying people are complaining from the price hikes, the drop in lira value, and inflation. However, instead of controlling the prices and solve the lira problem, the government chose to raise the minimum wage, which business owners are not very happy about, since they are already not meeting ends due to the economic situation in the country.
The increase in the minimum wage solves the problem just for right now. But if the inflation will keep staying higher like this, then in the long term, in a couple of months, the raise in the prices will eat the raise in the inflation and people will get poorer. Then it is for sure they will react against the AK Party in the elections. This may be the end of Erdogan era. What Erdogan hopes, they will not only increase their minimum wage, but they will also control the inflation by more production, by more export. Then they will also control the value of Turkish lira, then the inflation rate.
Investors and economists have been calling for the government to increase interest rates. However, it seems President Erdogan is sticking to his new plan, saying higher interest rates will worsen inflation. Analysts believe that the current economic crisis may put an end to Erdogan's era if he doesn't control the situation, especially now that both the ruling party and opposition are preparing for the elections. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Made in Iran. This label is tagged on all of the 9,000 products showcased here in this exhibition that has the same title, Made in Iran. It's the ninth edition of the annual tech event that brings Iranian local producers under one roof in Tehran to promote their products. The products cover 14 industrial sectors, including oil and petrochemical industries, electricity, agriculture, and health. In addition to acting as an advertising platform for the participating companies, the expo is a hot marketplace where manufacturers can sell their products on the spot. In fact, it's a win-win deal for both customers and producers because any product is sold with as much as 50% discount funded by Iran's Vice Presidency for Science and Technology, with the aim of supporting domestic production. Since the U.S.'s withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reinstatement of sanctions on Iran in 2018, Tehran has doubled down on its efforts to wean its economy off the ups and downs of politics. While the new Iranian government still believes in diplomacy, it says it will not tie the economy to the 2015 deal, and instead, it lends more support to domestic production.
Domestic production, as put by local brands here, will be the key to a resilient economy in Iran and a counterforce to U.S. sanctions that prevent Iranian industries from accessing foreign technology. Now it seems that the sanctions have given domestic production a boost here as the government seeks to drive the economy with Made in Iran products. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Islamophobia is everywhere, making news on a regular basis. From the U.S.,
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
To the halls of power in Europe.
Do I have a problem with Islam? Yes, I do have a problem with Islam.
Recently, this made headlines. Lauren Boebert joking about meeting fellow Congressman Ilhan Omar.
I look to my left, and there she is. Oh. Ilhan Omar. And I said, well, she doesn't have a backpack. We should be fine.
Muslim minorities everywhere are discussing solutions to the crisis. At the Islamophobia Awareness Conference organized by the Islamic Human Rights Commission based in London, the panel asked how much Muslim minorities can engage with their non-Muslim governments without compromising their faith.
Is our position one where we should engage in a kind of pragmatic way to just the ends justify the means? Or rather, do we follow, for theological reasons, a principled approach?
I would say, from my perspective, it's vital for diasporas, Muslim diasporas, the Ummah across the world, African and Caribbean diaspora, you have to engage.
Muslims are often forced to pledge allegiance to Western values in an overtly violent way. This is an old and primary tool of all oppressors to keep the oppressed occupied with the master's concerns. So refusing to do this can be powerful.
The depoliticization of mosques and the younger generation is a major concern. Efforts to prevent young people seeking justice and fighting oppression have intensified, raising the alarm.
There is a deliberate attempt to social engineer a type of Muslim which will not speak out, will be just obedient servant, will fit into the second-class citizenship which we all know is being promoted.
We asked conference moderator Professor Saeed Khan why such events matter.
Conferences like this are ones that help to then map out what is then not only the condition of Muslims, but to try to then understand where and how we place resources and strategies moving forward.
The far right is growing across Europe, manifesting in anti-immigration policies, bans on the Islamic dress code, and encouraging anti-Islam sentiment via the media and digital spaces. So these discussions have to be had if stereotypes targeting Muslims are to be confronted and deconstructed. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Mohammed once again tops the list for the most popular boy's name for newborns in the UK. According to parenting website Baby Centre, the name of Islam's holy prophet was the most popular name for boys in 2021, meaning the beloved Muslim name has held the top spot for the fifth year in a row. Sadly, British Muslims are living in an era of growing Islamophobia, and simply having a Muslim-sounding name could inspire discrimination. However, despite this, the name remains as popular as ever, and it's growing year upon year. So why do so many Muslim parents want to name their sons Mohammed? I asked a community leader to find out more.
When we pronounce the name of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, it is a full of barakah. And if you see the meaning of Muhammad literally, it means you can say praise.